Hi everyone, I'm Daniel. I want to start by thanking the organizers for organizing a nice conference, and also say I'm very happy to be back at Perimeter. I think this place is awesome. I'm going to tell you today about this work I did with Adam Boland, Sean Data, Bill Pfefferman, Daniel Greer, Philip Hernandez, and Michalos Maniak on Boson sampling with a linear number of modes. So if you don't know what these words mean, I'll define all of this shortly. But this is, I think, a nice theoretical result that people who work on this, on boson sampling, have been expecting something like this to be true for a while. And it does give kind of, I think, more robust complexity theoretic underpinnings to the sorts of experiments that have been performed recently. So, okay, so let's get started. Unless I misunderstood completely the name of this conference, I don't think I have to kind of motivate computational advantage from scratch. I'll just say, like, the reason I personally care about it. I'm more not so much interested in this sort of practical applications in the near future and so on. I'm more interested in the more foundational aspects of, you know, which kinds of physical systems are capable of demonstrating, you know, some raw computational power, like for quantum mechanics relative to classical mechanics or classical computing. And there are several proposals within this kind of framework. Boson sampling was maybe one of the first ones, at least, to put things in this particular way, but also kind of random circuit sampling. Juani talked about some of these earlier today. And so I'm going to tell you, as I said, specifically about boson sampling, and even more specifically about the sort of standard version of boson sampling. So I'm not going to talk a lot about Gaussian boson sampling, which is the sort of experiments that the sort of experimental groups have been doing, which is more kind of state of the art. I'm going to focus more on the original definition of boson sampling, although I do have some things to say about Gaussian boson sampling at the very end. Okay, so, you know, sort of take home message from this work, you know, it's going to be a theoretical work, theoretical advances in boson sampling, which are going to give, you know, maybe improved complexity theoretic arguments, especially in these limits of boson sampling. We're going to show that, you know, it works in the sense that it can still show that display some computational power, even if the number of modes grows only linearly with the number of photons. And this is kind of experimentally much more friendly than the previous results, which are all about quadratic scaling. And I'm going to define this more soon. But also what I'll try to convince you is that we have, you know, all of these results depend on some type of conjecture. But what I'll try to convince you is that we have kind of comparable evidence for the conjectures that we have to make compared to previous results. Okay, so this is the outline of my talk. I'm going to first tell you a little bit about what boson sampling is, in case you're not familiar, and what are the kind of current state-of-the-art experiments and why these experiments motivate the question that we're asking. Then I'm going to go in a little bit of detail through the outline of the original proof by Scott Aronson and Alex Arkhipov. And I kind of apologize in advance if this is old news for some people, but I'm still going to go through with it for two reasons. First, because I want to kind of get everyone up to speed, but also because, in essence, our result uses the same template of hardness proof as the original Aronson and Arkhipov paper, right? So basically, by going through the outline of the proof there, I can sort of show you where, you know, new challenges are going to appear that we're going to have to deal with in our case. And then I'm going to tell you how we solve these challenges, right? So this is going to be kind of slightly more technical, but the sort of what our contribution is, and then just kind of some open questions. So let me start with boson sampling. What's that? You know, it's basically a computational model defined by the following physical system, right? You start with some number n of photons with some number m of modes, right? So each mode can be either empty or occupied. And then these guys are gonna propagate through an interferometer, right? So just linear optics. And essentially what it means for it to be linear optics is that this transformation is completely defined at the level of the creation operators, right? So it's completely defined by what it does to the individual modes. And then, you know, if you look at this for a minute, you're going to see that this unitary transformation, even though, you know, in principle you have a very large Hilbert space, this unitary transformation actually lives in an m by n, like it's an n by n unitary, right? So the size of u is defined by the number of modes, okay? And then, you know, if photons interfere inside, and then you get, at the end, you detect how many photons came out in each mode, right? And then you do this several times, and you accumulate statistics, and then you have like a probability distribution associated with these outcomes, and this is gonna be the star of the show, right? So this is what we mean when we talk about simulating boson sampling. So whenever I say simulate, I mean produce a sample from this output distribution, right? That is defined essentially by this unitary transformation. And okay, so the computational task is to sample from this distribution. And you know, for a quantum device, this is easy by a theorist's definition of easy, not an experimentalist's definition of easy. And you know, but there is evidence that it is very hard for a classical computer to produce a sample from this distribution. And at the core of that hardness is the fact that the probabilities for bosons, the transition probabilities are given by permanence of some matrices, right? And I'm gonna tell you how to construct this matrix shortly, but basically the permanent is a notoriously hard function to compute, right? So you know, since transition probabilities are given by these very hard functions to compute, you sort of leverage that to say that there is, you know, some non-trivial computation going on the sort of quantum device. And just to sort of fix what the figure of merit is, if you have like an n photon transition, the time, the runtime of the algorithm that we know to compute this permanence goes as 2 to the n, right? So this is important because what it says is that the main figure of merit for complexity, right, what drives the complexity of the problem is the number of photons, not the number of modes, right? And this should already start giving you a glimpse of the fact that, you know, maybe the number of modes is less important than the number of photons, and it's a little bit of what I'm gonna try to convince you. And of course, you know, the quantum computer can't do this perfectly, so why would we ask the classical computer to be able to do it perfectly? And then a lot of work goes into showing that it's, you know, even approximate simulation is hard in the sense of, you know, sampling from some distribution d tilde, which has like total variation distance relative to the ideal one that's less than epsilon, right? So even approximate simulation to this level of precision is gonna be hard. And just to sort of tell a little bit of sort of the chronology of this, so this paper, Aronson and Akhmatov paper, was kind of put, like it appeared in the archive in 2012, and a few months later, 4x4 groups published like in the archive within 2 days of each other. You got 4 experiments, each with like 3 or 4 photons in a few, like maybe 5 or 10 modes. These were the sort of first small proof of principle experiments. And as far as I could tell, I've kind of looked at this recently, in at least this original boson sampling proposal that I described, the largest experiment that I could find used like 20 photons in 60 modes. So that's kind of within this original definition, that's how much we've kind of grew from the last, like over the last decade. However, you have larger experiments if you allow for some variants of boson sampling. So there's particularly one which is Gaussian boson sampling, where you replace the sort of Fock state inputs by these kind of two mode squeezed states. And there, you know, the largest experiments that we have in this Gaussian boson sampling variant are now much larger. So you can observe transitions of like a few hundred photons in a few hundred modes. Okay? Now, there's one caveat here, which is that the theoretical result, right, by Aronson and Akhmatov, needs the number of modes to grow quadratically with the number of photons. And if you look at this table, you can see that kind of experiments are far from it. Now, I put an asterisk here because, you know, it's a bit disingenuous to say this because this is about kind of how things scale, right? It's an asymptotic statement when I say that number of modes has to go quadratically, right? So if I have like 10 photons and 100 modes, you know, is the number of modes quadratic or is it just like 10 times n, right? So that doesn't make sense for any finite size experiment. The question's not really that well posed. But still, you know, even if you kind of think in terms of as experiments grow larger, like how many more modes can you get relative to the number of photons, even like from in a kind of like asymptotic, not asymptotic, but like as time passes, you know, this is still kind of pretty far. So, you know, our result that I'm gonna tell you is pretty much comes to the sort of rescue of this problem. And what we give is like comparable evidence that boson sampling remains hard even if the number of modes is only twice the number of photons, right? Now there are two important things here. One is that this is much more experimentally friendly, right? If you're gonna make an experiment with 100 photons, you don't wanna have like 10,000 modes that are kind of, most of them are just doing nothing. And then, you know, you need larger interferometers and you have losses and it becomes kind of horrible. But also, this is a kind of nicer thing, an easier thing to check, right? It's more transparent in the sense that, you know, you don't have to worry about this kind of distinction between these asymptotics. There are no prefactors here, right? So as long as the number of modes is twice the number of photons, you know, the result applies. That's the point. So then you can kind of straightforwardly check whether these experiments fall in this regime or not. Okay, so I'm gonna kind of go through an outline of the original hardness proof by Aronson and Arkhipov. And again, I apologize if this is a bit of old news, but basically I'm gonna break it into three steps, right? And I'm gonna kind of tell you what they are superficially now and go in a little bit of more detail later on. But basically you have three steps. The first one, you're gonna start with distributions and with the ability to approximate these distributions. And you're gonna use some machinery and end up with ability to estimate probabilities, right? And this step is very generic, and all of these random circuit sampling, all of these other proposals, they kind of look almost exactly the same. Then step two, you need to move from these probabilities to hard functions. So you're gonna have to argue that the probabilities in your experiment, in your model, are associated with some type of hard function, and for bosons, this is specific to each proposal, but for boson sampling, this is kind of almost immediate, right? Because of this permanent function. And then step three is where most of the magic comes in and where most of the work goes, which is you do need to invoke some type of conjecture. So all of these proposals invoke some type of kind of approximate hardness conjecture. And this is where most of our technical contributions go in as well, in kind of giving decent evidence for the conjectures, basically. So now let me kind of go through each of these steps in a little bit more detail. So this, you know, start with the initial assumption, which is that there is an efficient classical algorithm, right, that runs in polynomial time that can sample from this distribution du tilde, okay? Now, the way that this is gonna work is that you start with this assumption, and then you know, you run through a bunch of kind of chain of reasoning, and you add some extra conjectures, and at the end, you're going to arrive at a conclusion that's considered very unlikely, and the conclusion is that, you know, up to the validity of the conjectures, you sort of trace it back and say then that this assumption, that's evidence against this assumption, right? So what we want to get to at the end is not exactly a contradiction, but kind of. And you're gonna get, you know, we start assuming that there is an efficient classical algorithm, and therefore we're gonna conclude that, you know, this is unlikely. Okay, so so you imagine you have an efficient algorithm that, you know, takes as input the matrix U that describes the experiment. And you know, maybe internally the algorithm knows what the output distribution is in some sense, but you know, it's only asked to produce samples from this output distribution. That's what you require. Okay? Now, suppose that you can prove the following, which it is true, standardly true for boson sampling, is that you know, given some part, this is called hiding, and you say, like, given some outcome S, suppose that there is a class of states that all kind of look the same as S. And look the same here. I mean that, you know, for instance, if this U is uniformly random, this HS here will be all outcomes related to S by just relabeling of the output modes, right? So just by symmetry of the fact that this is uniformly random, all kind of output states that are just obtained by relabeling the modes kind of look the same. If you have that, then you can use a technique known as kind of Stockmeyer counting, Stockmeyer's algorithm, that allows you to obtain the following conclusion. That you have these kind of moderately super powerful, and I'm gonna tell you what that means shortly, but you have these moderately super powerful classical machines that can efficiently estimate the probabilities themselves. And when I say moderately super powerful, I mean essentially kind of a BPP machine with an NP oracle. So it is super powerful in the sense that it's much stronger than what we believe classical computers can do, but it's only moderately super powerful in a sense that's going to be clear shortly, right? So it's super powerful, but not horribly super powerful. Or, you know, kind of pictorially, you start by the assumption that there is an efficient classical computer can do this, and then you conclude that a kind of a slightly magical classical computer could produce an estimate of the probability itself. Right? So this is the first step. Now step two, so the first step was just you start with a ability to sample from probability distribution, and you arrive at the ability to estimate the probabilities. So step two, you now have to argue that the probabilities have to do with something that is hard. So for boson sampling, this is sort of trivial in the sense that, you know, if you have a transition from one state to another, so, you know, imagine I'm gonna call this state T and I'm gonna call this state S, right? The probability of starting in T and ending in S has to do with the permanence of a matrix. And the way that you build this matrix is the following. So you start with this large unitary matrix that describes the entire interferometer. And then you look at the input state. And for each photon in the input state, you're going to choose one of the columns of this matrix U. Okay? And then you look at the output state. And for each photon in the output state, you're going to choose one of the rows. And that's sort of the intersection between the two things is the matrix that you care about. And this is the one that you're going to compute the permanent of. So that's why I told you that the sort of the driving parameter here is the number of photons, right? Because even though this unitary here is a four-mode unitary, the permanent that you have to compute is actually of a 3x3 matrix, right? Depends on the number of photons. Okay, so this is how you build it. Now, I don't want to kind of spend too much time here, but I just want to do another example because there's one aspect that's going to be important when we consider our scenario, which is this. If you have a collision, right? So a collision means when two photons end up in the same mode. You basically play the same game, but then you have to start repeating the rows, right? So if you have two photons ended up in the same mode, you're going to choose that row twice. And that's important because if you start repeating the rows of the matrix too many times, then the permanence actually starts to become easier, right? So if you want to argue that these functions are hard, you don't want this to happen too much. And that's going to be one of the challenges that we're going to have to take care, like care about later on. Yes, this will be important. And this introduces a second figure of merit that's going to be important, which is the number of detector clicks. So what I mean now by detector click is just the number of non-empty output modes, regardless of how many photons are there, right? And this is a number that's in principle independent, not independent, but you know, it's not, it's kind of smaller, but independent from the number of photons, right? In standard boson sampling, you can show, I'm going to argue, that this almost never happens. So in standard boson sampling, you don't have to care about the fact that you have like number of photons and number of clicks as two independent things. But in our result, in our proposal, you're going to have to care about that. And you know, what I'm going to show you is that this is actually the right figure of merit to think about when you think about the complexity of the problem. Okay. So, you know, the conclusion now, when you combine step one and step two, is that these moderately super powerful classical machines that I mentioned before can outcompute permanence, right? So, okay, but, you know, so what, right? Why do we care about this? How hard are these permanents anyway? Well, the permanent function, in the worst case, is kind of a super extra hard. So this super extra hard is in contrast with just the moderately super powerful machines that I mentioned before. Right? So it's super extra hard in the sense that it is a Sharpe hard problem. Right? So if you look at the sort of structure of complexity classes, those moderately super powerful machines that I mentioned lived here, and the super extra hard functions live here. Right? So if these machines could compute these functions, this entire thing would collapse, and this is what you know, is called the collapse of the polynomial hierarchy, and you expect that to be unlikely. However, this is only true for the sort of worst case permanents, like the hardest ones are this hard to compute. But what about the permanents that appear in the experiment, right? Are those particularly hard to compute? And that's where you have to invoke some conjecture, okay? So, and as I said, this is kind of where the magic is gonna happen. So in the original Aronson-Arkhipov paper, what they did was they made two choices. So first they chose this interferometer matrix to be hard random, and they choose the number of modes to be quadratic in the number of photons, right? So when you make these two choices, two important things happen. First, these no collision states, where you never have two photons coming out in the same mode, they dominate. So you can just kind of ignore the possibility of having two photons coming out in the same mode. And the other thing that happens is that the entries of that smaller submatrix that I told you before, they look independent and Gaussian, right? And that makes the problem a bit easier to analyze. And these are kind of two independent reasons why the original paper requires this scaling. And these are two that are going to break down when we consider our result. And then they invoke two conjectures. So one of them is the permanence of Gaussian's conjecture, which says that, you know, permanence of Gaussian matrices are typically Sharpe hard, right? So it just says, you know, here you argued that, like, oh, sorry. So, you know, here you argue that these are the matrix that are going to appear in the experiment, and then you conjecture that they are particularly hard. And there's another conjecture about anti-concentration, that they don't concentrate too much around zero, but I'm not going to spend much time talking about this. Okay? So then sort of a recap of the entire argument is this. So when you combine those first two steps that I showed you, you know, you get this conclusion that these moderately super powerful classical machines can approximate Gaussian permanence. And when you combine these two conjectures, you get the conclusion that Gaussian permanents are sharply hard to compute. And when you now combine these two statements, you conclude that, you know, these BPP within p-oracle machines can solve these sharply hard problems. And since this is considered a very unlikely thing because of the polynomial hierarchy and so on, this then counts as evidence against that original assumption that this classical simulation of boson sampling existed in the first place, at least up to the validity of those two conjectures, right? So this is kind of the skeleton of this proof. Okay. So now, let me tell you what changes when we now don't want to make this assumption that the number of modes is quadratic, right? So what if we want to talk about a situation where the number of photons modes is only linear in the number of photons? You know, experimentalists would be very happy with us if we managed to do that. Well, you know, easy, right? Just write a new conjecture and you're done. Go back home, right? Now, of course, you know, I still have 20 minutes, so I have to fill this up with a little bit more than that. But, you know, let's take a look, a bit closer look at the conjecture in the original Aronson Arkhipov paper, right? So what evidence did we have that that conjecture was true, right? So you can restate it in these terms, like permanents of n by n matrices of IID Gaussian elements are sharply hard to compute to sufficiently high precision most of the time, right? That's what kind of conjecture informally says. And there's a subsequent paper, right, by Adam Boland, Bill Pfefferman, and collaborators, where they show that there is actually a very well-defined gap here, because you can prove using polynomial interpolation and some other stuff that I'm going to mention a bit later, you can prove that it is sharply hard to compute these particular permanents to an error that scales like this, right? And the conjecture is that it would be still be sharply hard to a much to compute them to a much to this precision, right? And then the gap between these two things is what we don't know how to close. And some version of this gap exists for all of these kind of quantum computational advantage proposals. And what I'm going to try to convince you, argue, is that for our case, the case that we care about, we have exactly the same gap, right? So the distance between what we are able to prove and what we would want to be true is going to be the same for boson sampling in the linear case, okay? And, you know, this is what we would want to be true. If this was true, if you could prove this, then boson sampling would be kind of unconditionally hard, at least up to the collapse of the polynomial hierarchy. You wouldn't need any conjectures, okay? Well, there's the kind of anti-concentration one, but, you know, that's less important. Now, the problem now is that in our case, we don't have these Gaussian matrices, right? This is going to break down for many reasons. And then we're going to need to take, you know, take into account all of the ways in which this breaks down to provide a kind of results concerning a similar gap. So three new challenges appear that we had to take care of. First of all, the submatrices now do not have IID Gaussian entries anymore, right? So the entries are very correlated. So just to recap, in the previous case, you know, we have that the original matrix has size n squared, and you're going to look at a kind of small n by n matrix here. Now the thing is, if the large matrix is uniformly random, when you look at a sufficiently small submatrix, you don't see the constraints of that come from the fact that the large matrix is unitary. Right? So the large matrix is unitary, so you know that the sort of columns have to be normalized and orthogonal to each other, but those constraints become kind of invisible if you're looking at sufficiently small submatrices. However, now, that's not what happens, because now we have kind of the number of modes is much smaller, and we're going to have to kind of look at relatively larger submatrices. And now the constraints that the matrix, large matrix is unitary, they become apparent. And what this means is that the entries here now start looking very correlated in a very important way. So that's the first thing that we're going to have to take care of. The second one is that collisions are not unlikely anymore. So in the original boson sampling paper, you had this called the bosonic birthday paradox, which says that, you know, in that regime where the number of modes is very large, what happens is that the interferometer, there are so many modes that the interferometer kind of spreads out the photons in the output very well, and you almost never observe two photons coming out in the same mode. But that's not going to work here anymore. And the permanents that we have to care about now have a bunch of repetitions in them, a bunch of repeated rows. And finally, there's one other part which the outcomes don't look the same now anymore. So before I told you that like all outcomes are kind of related to each other, but just relabeling the modes. But now actually all of these different ways in which the photons can cluster together at the output, they're all kind of inequivalent, right? So the output space kind of shatters into exponentially many different inequivalent subspaces, right? And we kind of have to prove that in all of these subspaces, or in most of them, you can still hide something that's hard. Right, so that's going to be the sort of third challenge that we care about. So now let me tell you what our contributions are and how we deal with these challenges specifically. So we define a new problem, which we call the subunitary permanent estimation with repetitions, or super, which, you know, is a nice acronym because it's super hard. And the problem is to estimate, basically by definition, estimate whatever comes out of the boson sampling experiment, right? So, you know, estimate the permanent of a matrix where, you know, U was drawn on a hard random, and you look at a submatrix of it, possibly with some repetitions dictated by the outcome S, right? So basically, by construction, just, you know, compute whatever probability is coming out, essentially. And our main result is that this problem is sharply hard if you admit, like, some additive error that goes like this, right? So this is going to be the weaker version of the conjecture that we would like to be true, but that we can prove. So, you know, as I said before, what this is going to imply is a kind of gap that's essentially the same size of the gap that we had in the previous case, right? So this is what we can show, and that's a main result. And we also prove that this is what would be sufficient. And this is what I mean when I say that we're giving comparable evidence towards the conjecture, that the new conjecture that we have to make here. Some other important things that we have to take care of. First, you know, have to do a bunch of combinatorics to argue that these number of collisions is not too large, right? So as I said, you know, as you start getting many repetitions in the permanent, it starts getting easier. So if it happened that, you know, all photons ended up in a single mode, for example, if that was a common thing, then the permanents would actually be trivial to compute, right? So part of the story is that we still have to show that this doesn't happen that much. And we do need to make some kind of small modifications to this original template from the original paper. Okay, so now let me tell you how we deal with each of these challenges in turn. So let me start with the second one, which is a bit easier to describe what the solution is, right? So now we have to look at permanents that have repeated rows. We have to worry about this. So how do we deal with this? So for this, we import a result from a previous paper that I wrote with Daniel Greer and the guys at Xanadu in Toronto, where we basically showed that, you know, the worst case permanent when you have repetitions is as hard as the worst case permanent without repetitions. Now, this is very ambiguously stated, so let me kind of give you a concrete example to make it clear. Imagine that you have this permanent, this matrix A, okay? And it has this kind of four independent elements. Now, I'm going to build a matrix out of it that has a bunch of repeated rows. And what we showed was that there is a prescription of fill, because you need a square matrix to compute the permanent, right? So if you start repeating rows, you need to kind of fill in the extra columns with something. And what we showed is that there is a prescription to fill these extra columns such that basically the permanent of this guy is proportional to the permanent of this guy, right? Or in other words, computing the permanent of these two guys is one's as hard as the other, right? So computing this is as hard as computing this, right? Now, I remind you that whenever you had repeated rows, that was because you had collisions, so you had more than one photon in that mode. So the number of kind of independent rows that you have has to do with the number of detector clicks, right? So each independent row here comes from a different output detector that detected something, right? And the repetitions just come from that detector detecting many photons. So in other words, what we're saying is that the complexity of the problem is controlled by the number of clicks and not by the number of photons, right? So that's the first part. So the next thing that we have to do is argue that, you know, clicks are a thing that you have a lot of, right? So you don't have like too few detectors clicking in any experimental run, because then that problem would become easy. So then we prove the second lemma, that if you have like the number of modes is proportional to the number of photons, then the number of detectors that click is also proportional to the number of photons, right? So by having fewer modes, collisions become more likely, but you only take a kind of proportional hit to the number of, to the sort of complex size of the problem, the complexity of the problem, right? And in particular, if m equals to n here, this is becomes a half, right? So the number of clicks is just gonna be half of the number of photons. So it's as if you were paying half of your photons in cost for having just like too few modes, essentially. But the corollary from this, together with what I told you previously, was that most outcome probabilities in a boson sampling experiment in this regime can still embed some sharp P-hard problem in the worst case, right? So you're not in this bad situation where you only have like a very rare few events that are hard. Most events are still kind of equally hard. Now the last one, which is a bit more technical, which is how do we deal with these kind of correlated entries, okay? So I won't go into kind of too much detail, but basically what you have to do is this sort of worst to average case reduction. So let me tell you how this goes in the original Aronson Arkhipov paper again, and then I'll tell you how it goes in our case, okay? So basically the idea is the following. Imagine you want to compute the permanence of this worst case matrix, right? And what you can do is you can smuggle this guy into a random matrix, right? So basically what you show is if you take a random matrix R and you add a tiny bit, T is small, so you add a tiny bit of the matrix that you care about, this matrix, which is sort of the sum here, this X matrix, is so kind of sufficiently random. And I'm gonna tell you how shortly, but basically what happens is that, so this is a property of the Gaussian ensemble, this fact, but what it implies is that if you can compute the permanence for these Gaussian matrices, then you can compute the permanence for this red matrix A here. And the way that you do this is basically polynomial interpolation, right? So if you look here, the permanence has this sort of polynomial character. So what I'm saying is, like, if you took the permanence of this X here and you computed it for a bunch of different values of T, all close to zero, right? For all of these values, this matrix looks very random. But you could use polynomial interpolation to sort of infer what the value of the permanence is kind of far from the region that you're looking at, right? And this polynomial interpolation technique, it kind of makes the errors blow up. So kind of keeping track of the errors is part of the challenge. But basically, this technique is what gives you this gap, right? So this known fact that tells you that it's sharply hard to estimate the permanence to this precision, this bad scaling here comes from the sort of error blow up in this polynomial interpolation technique, okay? now, the problem with this is the original. Do you have to take the mic?
So in the interpolation there, do you just have to interpolate on the blue region to get the point in the permanent?
The problem is that the assumption here, what you want to prove, right, is that computing the permanence for random matrices is as hard as computing the permanence for the worst matrix.
Yeah.
Right? And the problem is that this ensemble where X is drawn from, right, it only looks Gaussian for values of T that are very small. Right? So in a sense, you're only allowed to probe the value of this polynomial close to t equals zero. Right? And then what you want to sort of conclude is that if you're looking very close to zero, but for a bunch of different values, you can sort of interpolate this value that's very far from zero. Right? Because you want to connect the sort of ability to compute this very hard permanence with the conjecture that you want, which is the ability to compute the permanence of random, of like Gaussian matrices. Right? So if by smuggling this guy here, this thing looks very different from Gaussian, so it was very clear that you had kind of hidden the permanent that you care about in the random matrices, then all of this would break down. That answer the question?
Yeah, I guess I was just saying it's pretty, I don't know much about polynomial interpolation, but I guess it says that it's pretty powerful, right? Like you need...
But the problem is that, remember that, the question is to approximate the permanence, so you can assume that you're making a little bit of error here, and if you're only allowed to probe in a very tiny region that's very far from the point that you care about, this error kind of blows up horribly, right? So it's kind of powerful, but the error kind of just exponentially blows up, and that's why you kind of, you know, you would want this kind of exponential, and you want to get something that's much worse, and it's just from the kind of error that you accumulate in the polynomial interpolation. And in fact, I'm pretty sure that you can actually prove that these techniques will not be enough to close this gap. So you're not just going to close this gap just by polynomial interpolation, just by kind of fundamental limits of how this error kind of scales. Okay, now we need a similar thing, and I'm just going to gloss this over this a little bit, but we need a similar result, and it's one of the things that we prove, that is a lemma that's essentially it's analogous result for these permanents that we care about that are not of Gaussian matrices, right? So what this says is that even though kind of the entries are very correlated and they don't look like independent and Gaussian anymore, some symmetry of this kind still holds. So, you know, if you have R drawn from this ensemble that I described, or you take a hard random unitary matrix and look at a kind of large submatrix, so if R is taken from this ensemble, then X is also kind of approximately taken from this ensemble as long as T is small, right? So basically, it's just saying that, you know, this ensemble has the same symmetry properties as the Gaussian ensemble. And this was the kind of hardest part, doesn't look like it, but it's like the hardest part of the argument is proving this. And if you kind of mix in with some slightly better polynomial interpolation, you get the main result, which is that the super problem is sharply hard to this kind of additive precision here, which then recovers that gap that I told you with sort of the same size for our case than for the original boson sampling case. So that's basically our result. Just sort of to recap, you know, our contributions is we propose this new computational problem, which we call super, which is essentially just compute permanents that come out of boson sampling experiments when the number of modes is linear. We prove that it is hard to sum additive error, and we conjecture and prove that it would be enough if it were hard to kind of much better error. And the gap between what we know and what we kind of conjecture and what we want to be true is similar to the standard boson sampling proposal. Now, I want to add an asterisk here, and I think I would put less emphasis on this point than maybe my co-authors would, because, you know, there are a few different reasons that you can give kind of evidence towards a conjecture, right? So either you can kind of prove a weaker version of that conjecture, and in that sense, kind of our result is equivalent to the original boson sampling one. But there are like other reasons why you might believe a conjecture. Maybe it kind of very naturally stated, or people have been working a long time trying to either prove it or disprove it and haven't managed. So, you know, from this other point of view, our conjecture is kind of, you know, new and less natural than the original boson sampling one. So when I say that they're kind of comparable evidence, I'm speaking at this level of, you know, what we can say about the best weaker version of the conjecture. But, you know, this gap exists for all of these proposals and it's open for all of them. Now, the payoff is that now you're looking at a much more experimentally friendly regime. And, you know, like maybe experimentalists don't care about this m equals n squared, right? So if you look at the table that I showed originally, they are doing their experiments with how many ever photons and modes they can. And they don't particularly care about maybe the theoretical underpinnings, but we're kind of retroactively saying that, you know, yes, the regime that they have used in their experiments for their own reasons is actually still good, right? So that's the kind of point. And, you know, all of this is just like standard boson sampling, not Gaussian boson sampling, but we're on that, right? So the current version of the paper does not have the Gaussian boson sampling result. The internal version between the authors also does not have, because we haven't had time to kind of write it down yet, but it's kind of, the result's kind of floating in our minds, and we're pretty sure that it is true for Gaussian boson sampling as well, because nothing here relies too much on boson sampling that wouldn't also hold for Gaussian boson sampling. And, you know, there's a bunch of other things, like we haven't really said anything about kind of finite size experiments. So if you ask me, oh, you know, if you have like 100 photons and 200 modes, you know, what would be the what the runtime of an algorithm to simulate that? That we don't know, right? We haven't said anything about that. So, you know, I think an interesting avenue of research would be like, what's the best algorithm that you can write for the sort of classical competition, right? So if you leverage these repetitions to make kind of a slightly faster classical simulation, for example. And also, you know, would this then imply that our conjecture is like less likely to hold than the original Aronson-Akhipov one, right? So I said that we give comparable evidence, but the conjecture is still kind of logically independent from each other in some sense. Or at least ours is kind of, might be false where theirs is true, so we don't know. And we haven't looked at kind of experimental noise, mode mismatch, losses, and all of that. We haven't worked on any of that yet. I think that's also kind of interesting. Okay, thanks. That's what I had to say.
Hi, thanks for the talk. So you mentioned that you've got a slightly better version of polynomial interpolation. Is there any way of applying that to the original problem to kind of get better results there? I assume the answer is no, else you might have done it, but.
So actually, let me just clarify that point. So when I said like that for boson sampling, you have this gap, right? So this is actually not in the original Aronson-Akhipov paper. So this gap comes from this paper by Adam Boland, Bill Fasherman, and collaborators, and this is where they prove this new improved polynomial interpolation, right? So this gap for the original results, this gap is already a consequence of this kind of better polynomial interpolation that I mentioned, right? So that's yeah. In the original boson sampling paper, the analogous to this was like much, much worse.
Okay, thanks.
Hi. So the assumption of choosing your states Har or unitary, there was this assumption of Har randomness.
Yeah.
And how realistic is it? I mean, your circuits, they are just a bunch of beam splitters and phase shifters, and if they are short, then the assumption will not be very accurately satisfied. If they are longer, it will be better satisfied. So how stable is your whole proof to deviations from Hall randomness, and can you be more precise for how long your circuits need to be so that the assumption is well satisfied?
Right, so we don't have a good, that's a very good question. We don't have a good answer. So what I can say is like if you're doing it the way I describe, where you just like choose a Hall random matrix and now you want to write that as a sort of circuit of beam splitters, right? The depth of that circuit is going to have to be linear in the number of modes, which is then linear in the number of photons, right? In a sense, that is a very large improvement relative to the original result, because in the original result, the number of modes is quadratic in the number of photons, and so the depth of the circuit would be quadratic, right? So now in this new version, the depth of the circuit is linear. But it's still linear, which is horrible, because if you have like losses and there's a probability of loss at each beam splitter, the loss kind of accumulates exponentially. So having kind of a linear, like an interferometer that has size that grows with the number of photons is not very good. Now, I have looked with Michal at like, can you use some sort of like polynomial design arguments here to say that, you know, if you have like a random circuit that has very short depth, like how fast does that start to look like how random? And we have looked at that, but we don't know. So, you know, kind of formally, technically, as it is, you would need still a kind of very long circuit, a very long interferometer, like linear in the number of photons. And okay, I don't know to what extent that can be improved.
Good, thank you.
But that's a very good question that I'm very interested in.
Rob?
One question. So you have this other paper about shallow circuits with constant depth, right?
Yeah.
And that's exact simulation is hard.
That's exact simulation, yes.
Do you have any similar result, not for exact, or maybe, no?
Yeah, no, I think like the proof techniques behind that other paper, which is about kind of constant depth boson sampling, but it's only about exact hardness, the proof, like it's the proof techniques there are extremely weak to show this sort of thing. So it's kind of, I would be very surprised if those constructions could be leveraged to get a kind of a similar result as this one. But maybe.
Can I ask another one? So you mentioned you're comparing the n squared versus n that you now have.
Yeah.
But the original result was not for n squared. Strictly speaking, was for n to the fifth or something.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, it's for n to the fifth, but I don't think anyone takes that n to the fifth very seriously. I mean, it seemed like a little bit of a glitch of the proof that, you know. So the point is that in the original AA paper, you needed the number of modes to grow as the fifth power of the number of photons, just so that the submatrices actually looked Gaussian. But like even in that paper, they already said that, you know, it's likely that n squared would be enough. And I think like most people kind of believe that n squared would be enough. Although you're right that like technically the original paper is not about n squared, but if you know, no one takes that n to the fifth power too seriously, I think.
I just maybe have a quick question. So it looks like if only we could prove that these problems are sharp P complete. Remind me, do we have a separation between sharp P and P?
Sorry?
Do we have a separation between sharp P and P? And P? Is sharp P actually known to be hard?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, up to the collapse of the polynomial hard, right?
Okay.
So we don't have proven that yet. That's true.
We haven't proven that.
So there's also an extra conjecture that's kind of seeping in implicitly that the polynomial hierarchy is infinite in the first place.
Yes.
That's true.
Okay. Any more questions? Okay, if not, let's thank our speaker.
Okay, thanks.